much more wide-open and fast game with fewer pile-ups. I had the ball and was running downfield when I got caught up in a tackle from a flanker who was playing on Shawnee's team. In rugby, when you're tackled, you have to let go of the ball. Usually, you do it in a way that makes it easy for your own teammates to pick it up. But when I released the ball, no one was there to get it, so Shawnee stepped right over me and poached the ball away for his team. And the terrible thing is, right when he stepped through, he planted his foot between my legs. Yeah. Like the world wasn't big enough for Shawnee to find somewhere else to put his fucking foot. And that's how Shawnee Russell Flaherty, my good friend, the same guy who contrived so many internet hoaxes about so many people, the same guy who told Annie Altman, the girl I am insanely in love with, that I got drunk with Chaz Becker the night before school began, that same guy wearing size 12 metal cleats, stepped right onto my balls. I became a black hole. Let me explain the physics of having your balls stepped on. The entire Ryan Dean West universe instantly collapsed to the size of a 5/8-inch metal cleat stud, and everything I knew, everything I would ever know, got sucked into that pinpoint of agony. Newton obviously skipped that one crucial law. When my hearing came back, I heard Shawnee saying, "Uh-oh." And I'm pretty sure that everyone in the Pacific Northwest heard Ryan Dean West shout, "You stepped on my fucking nuts, you son of a bitch!" Yes, I will admit to cussing that time. My universe gradually began expanding, but so did the agony. I could think again, and the thinking led to a heightened sensation of pain, if there could be such a thing, and a frightening realization, too. "Mrs. Singer, catastrophic penis injury. You have got to be fucking kidding me. I must be out of my mind." And as I lay on my side in the fetal position, hands clutching for what I could only imagine in my most horrific visions had been damaged beyond salvation, my teammates formed for the second time in the past 24 hours a mournful and morbidly fascinated circle around me. "He's dead," one of them said. "If he isn't dead, he should kill himself immediately," another added. "Did you really step on his nuts?" a third one. I tried to answer them, but the only sound I could make sounded something like, and shuddering, lying there with my face in an expanding puddle of mud, I realized I couldn't unclench my jaw. Coach M blew his whistle to break practice. I rolled onto my back in the mud, my face turned up into the rain, eyes blurred, scanning the darkness of the clouds for the giant face of a mocking god who might be up there laughing at my stitched and stomped-on skinny bitch ass. "Not exactly the best 2 days of your life, eh, Ryan Dean?" Coach tried to smile, looking down at me, rain dripping from the brim of his hat. "Can you move?" And Shawnee fell beside me, trying to help me sit up. But he was kind of laughing when he said, "Dude, my bad, Ryan Dean. And I know you've probably waited all your life to hear another guy say this to you, but dude, how are your balls?" And all at once, I somehow instantly composed a haiku in my mind about how much I hated Shawnee Flaherty and, in a simultaneous flash of inspiration, derived a kind of mathematical, tautological formula about reality that I could easily envision as a Venn diagram. Finding humor and getting hit in the balls equals the universe minus one. Shawnee helped me to my feet. My head was groggy, my eyes swirled with tears of pain, and I felt like throwing up. The other guys were already making their way into the locker room and the warmth of the showers. I slipped my hand down inside my compression shorts just to make sure everything was still attached properly. Something stung, and when I pulled my hand out and looked at my fingers, there was blood on them. Crap. Chapter 40. Shawnee Flaherty, asshole, you stepped on my nuts. Please, someone kill me. Here, I said, dropping the folded paper beside Shawnee where he sat eating dinner. I wrote a haiku about how much I hate your stinking guts, Shawnee.
Dude, how gay are you?
Shawnee said in his usual deadpan, focusing on his food and opening the note.
You wrote me a haiku about your balls.
JP was just sitting down across the table. I didn't care. I wasn't talking to him, and he wasn't going to keep me away from my friends. And then Joey asked, What did the doctor say, Ryan Dean?
Yeah, here's another thing I realized.
You'd think that receiving an injury to your balls is probably the worst thing that can possibly happen to any guy, but it's not. Going to the doctor for an injury to your balls is much, much worse. So here I was, sitting down to eat among my friends and enemies alike, with the alluringly hot and faintly mustached Isabel, wide-eyed and rapt attentiveness, no doubt taking it all down so she could get right back to the recuperating Annie Altman and deliver an update on the status of Ryan Dean West's testicles.
Was that hot nurse there?
Shawnee practically drooled.
No, I said. Just Dr. No Gloves.
Ew, Shawnee said. Did he touch your little westicles?
I took a bite of chicken, pretending that was all I was going to say about the matter. I looked over at JP and he looked away.
Are you going to tell us or what?
Shawnee said impatiently. I paused to gather my thoughts.
Do you believe in witches?
I asked.
I give up, Shawnee said and took a drink of milk.
I looked at Isabel. It was kind of embarrassing, but not as embarrassing as telling everyone in the infirmary why I showed up, scared, pale, and covered in mud with my hand thrust down my shorts, holding on to my balls. Even my friends were too embarrassed to go there with me, afraid they might have to face their own fears and watch in that cold examination room while I sat naked on a rustling paper sheet and the doctor looked me over. Head wounds were one thing, but like I said, no boy ever wants to come face to face with a catastrophic penis injury.
It's just a cut, I said, on my balls. He put a band-aid on it.
Was it a SpongeBob band-aid?
Shawnee asked, almost spitting out his milk when he said it. Even Joey laughed. I am such a loser.
Dude, Shawnee announced. How awesome is that? You are the only guy I've ever known in my entire fucking life who had to have a doctor put a band-aid on his ballsack. That's the kind of thing you just can't make up. Ryan Dean West, you are going to be a fucking legend.
Shawnee, I said, I can't even begin to put into words how much I hate you right now.
Aw, I love you too, Ryan Dean, he said.
Chapter 41. I never could sleep the night before a game, especially a first game. After dinner, Joey kept his appointment for our calculus study group with Megan at the library, and I came back to O Hall alone and tried to relax in bed. But it was absolutely impossible to get comfortable, considering the locations of my injuries. And I know I'm a pig for thinking it, but I really wanted to make out with Megan again. So I just lay there staring up at the ceiling with my knees bent, listening to Chaz's breathing, wondering if Annie had read my note, and what she was thinking about at that moment if she was awake like me. And I knew that if you could keep score for such a thing, and of course I did keep that score, my degree of loserdom would be nothing short of godlike. So I drew a graph I called Ryan Dean West Loser Score Tally, in which I gave a numerical value to the following: alcoholic, virgin pervert, band-aid on ball sack, the top scorer, stitches in head, and 14-year-old skinny-ass bitch. To make matters even worse, by midnight, I had to pee. But there was no way in hell I was going to go down that hallway on the night before a game and run the risk of a face-to-face with Mrs. Singer again. So I held it as long as I could, but that just made my band-aided wound hurt more. When I couldn't stand it anymore, I fumbled around the side of the mattress where I stored that Gatorade bottle Joey brought me when I was sick. I unscrewed the top. It still smelled like lemon. And kneeling on the top bunk, I filled it to within half an inch of overflowing. The Ryan Dean West emergency Gatorade bottle nighttime urinal was an invention of depraved genius. After a quick check on the snugness of my Band-Aid and pausing momentarily to wonder how many days it might take to fall off, since, sweet mother of God, there was no way I was going to yank it and all the hairs affixed to it off, I screwed the lid back on as tightly as possible, tucked the bottle down by my feet, where I noticed it produced a very pleasant warmth, pulled the covers back over me, and finally went to sleep. Chapter 42. At 6 in the morning, we were all on the bus heading down from Pine Mountain to play our first rugby match of the year. It had stopped raining during the night, so it was going to be a perfect and soggy day for rugby. 25 players rode on the bus, most of us stretched out in our own seats, along with the coach and a couple other adults. And I swear I had to go from seat to seat and personally tell the story of the Band-Aid on my balls to every one of the boys who hadn't been there at dinner the night before. It was a 4-hour bus ride to Sacred Heart. Our kickoff was scheduled for 1 o'clock, and as always after the game, in a rugby tradition called a social, we would sit down with the opposing team and have dinner before our ride back to Pine Mountain. We always had to wear our school uniforms and ties whenever we showed up for a rugby match. That was just the way things were done. So every one of us knew it was going to be a long and tiring day. But we didn't know just how tough and unexpected things would actually turn out to be. We sang almost the entire way there. I don't know how Coach M put up with it. It was like he was deaf or something because he never showed the slightest expression, even when the songs got completely vulgar. It was like singing was the only time he'd tolerate our cussing, and he'd just keep his attention pinned on his notebook, where he'd organize rosters, medical forms, and notes on plays. But I could tell the singing was making the driver of our chartered bus really agitated. He started looking so frustrated and mad. But I could hear Coach M explain to him in his Henry Higgins tone of voice, "They are a rugby team. They sing. There's nothing I, you, or God can do about it beyond hope that they eventually tire." And just before we got to the field, someone got into our first aid kit and secretly passed around Band-Aids to everyone on the team except me. So when we arrived at the locker rooms at Sacred Heart and the headmaster, who was dressed in his full priestly attire, and a couple nuns from the school greeted us, every one of our players, with the exception of me, came down the steps at the front of the bus wearing a black and blue school tie, white dress shirt, and khaki pants with a Band-Aid stuck across his fly. Nice. We changed into our uniforms and took the field to warm up. I had my head taped up, and I felt like I was completely ready to go. When Sacred Heart came out to begin stretching, we ran around them on the field singing She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, which was the only song we were allowed to sing at a Catholic school because it wasn't really dirty. It was just about a guy who fathers an illegitimate child and then gets his balls shotgunned off by the girl's father. Tame by our standards, and as Coach said, it wasn't likely to incite a religious war or anything since it contained a moral lesson. But the Sacred Heart boys didn't think it was very funny, and instead of singing something back to us, which is what any decent and proper rugby team would do, they just scowled and prayed. I am not religious at all. Some of the kids at PM are, though, and we do have a non-denominational chapel on the grounds for kids who don't go home on weekends, but we always prayed before games, and praying with the team was the only kind of praying I ever felt good about. So, a few minutes before kickoff, we would all take to our knee in a circle and put our arms around each other, and Kevin Cantrell would stand over us and give thanks for the day and for the other team that was there to play with us, and for being able to play the greatest sport that was ever created, and hope that everyone, even our opponents, would be safe and have fun. Then, just a few minutes before the game, Coach M pulled me aside and told me that he wasn't going to let me start, that he was putting in Mike Bagnuolo, a sophomore winger who was actually older than me, because he wanted to see how Bags could handle himself. Of course, I was crushed, but I knew better than to say anything or try to plead with Coach. That's just something you never do on the sideline of a game. At least Bags was wearing number 16, and I got to keep the 11, so everyone knew who the real left wing was. That's how numbers work in rugby. A player doesn't pick his number. His position on the team determines that, and it's something that never gets messed with. So all I could do was watch the game start from the sideline and just hope that by some miracle I'd get a chance to sub in. Joey was standing there with us when Coach M made his decision, and I could see he was upset about the call because he looked like he felt sorry for me too. But he shook Bags's hand and said, "I'll be looking for you out there." And then he said, "Sorry, Ryan Dean, Coach is just being careful." And he tapped the bandage on my head. "I know that, Joey, but I still totally hate JP. You remember how I told you to get your shit together? Well, Megan couldn't stop talking about you last night. So when's it going to happen, Ryan Dean?" Then Joey ran off to his spot on the field, and all I could do was watch the game begin. The worst part of it, worse than Joey's scolding, because I knew he was right, was that it was the kind of game I love to play in. Our teams were so evenly matched, and every time it looked like a score was about to happen, the other team would crank up its defense and force a turnover. So, it went that way, scoreless, for almost the entire 35-minute half, and then finally, JP got called on a dangerous tackle, and Sacred Heart scored a penalty kick just as the half ended, to go up to 3-0. And I was kind of glad that JP was the one who gave up those points, because everyone could see how terrible he felt about it. Bastard. In rugby, halftime only lasts 5 minutes, and the players are not allowed to leave the field. And unlike other sports, there are no substitutions where a player can go out and come back in, which I think is one of the reasons the football team hated us so much, because rugby players had to be in such better condition than players in just about any other sport. During halftime, though, Coach brought the team in and said, "Bags is coming out. Ryan Dean, mind your head." And that absolutely made my day. Joey shook my hand, and I pulled him close to me and whispered, "Look, I swear I will take care of the Megan thing as soon as I can. Just get me the ball." "Okay," he said. And he did. About 5 minutes into the half, Joey skipped the ball past both of our centers right into my hands, and all I had to do was beat the opposing winger, who had no chance of catching me. I centered the ball right between the posts and put it down to score a try. And I did think about Annie as soon as I got to my feet. Shawnee was our team's kicker, and he scored the conversion, so PM went up 7-3. We chest-bumped each other after his kick, and Shawnee laughed, saying, "I think that's the gayest thing I've ever done." And I said, "No, it's not even close. You wrote me a haiku, and you asked me how my balls were yesterday, remember?" The score stayed locked at 7-3, and we ended up winning the game. We had to shower and change back into our ties before the post-game social. The food was great, and the best part of the afternoon was that the Sacred Heart boys all had cell phones, and Coach let us borrow them to call our parents and tell them about the game. I borrowed the phone from the number 14 winger, the boy I outran to score my try, and he was real nice about it, too. But he did promise they'd even it up against us when we played them during the regular season. And yes, Cell phones can apparently be used to dial directly into hell, because my call went something like this. Mom.
Hello?
Ryan Dean West.
Hi, Mom. It's me, Ryan Dean.
I always said that on the phone, like there was someone else who might call her Mom, even though I don't have any brothers or sisters. Mom.
Oh, my God, baby, are you hurt again? How's your head?
I was never allowed to call during the week. PM rules. Ryan Dean West.
I'm fine, Mom.
I wasn't about to say anything about the Band-Aid on the balls thing. God. Who would ever have the guts to talk about something like that with their mom? Ryan Dean West continued.
I'm calling from our game. We won. I scored a try.
Mom.
Your dad's going to be so happy to hear about that.
Ryan Dean West.
Is Dad there?
Mom.
No, sweetie, he's in New York.
Then she sounded really serious. Mom continued.
Ryan Dean, how did you get a phone?
Ryan Dean West.
Well, I just wanted to tell you, Mom, because Coach is letting us use the other boys' phones today, since we're not at school. But I wanted to let you know, and to say thanks to you and Dad for letting me go stay with Annie this weekend.
Mom.
Oh, Ryan Dean?
Ryan Dean West.
What?
Mom.
Is that why you wanted to talk to Dad?
Awkward silence. Mom continued.
Do you need to ask him about girl things? Because I spoke with your father in New York, and yesterday I FedExed you a box of condoms and a pamphlet about, you know, how to have sex for the first time. You should be getting it this afternoon, sweetie.
You know, I have lived my entire life, and never once, not one time, have I ever talked to my mother about condoms and how to have sex the first time. I felt my ears turning red. I am such a fucking loser. My life is hell. No worse than that. My life is a Band-Aid on my ballsack. Ryan Dean West.
No, please, God, tell me you did not do that. Mom? Fuck.
Okay, I'll be honest. I do not say fuck to my mom. During the ensuing and second awkward silence, I spent a moment seriously thinking about killing myself. Mom.
Well, you should ask your friend if she would like to visit Boston sometime.
Your friend.
Oh yeah, Mom, just stock up on the rubbers and porn.
Ryan Dean West.
Okay, Mom.
I realized how deeply I hated talking to my mom ever since I became a teenager. And if there's a more potent deterrent to perversion than the Niagara Falls of razor-sharp ice shards poured down your pants, it has got to be talking to my mom about condoms and how to have sex for the first time. Ryan Dean West continued.
Well, tell Dad I said hi. I should probably go now, Mom.
Mom.
I love you, Ryan Dean.
Ryan Dean West, garbled so hopefully the boy next to him doesn't understand.
I love you too, Mom. Bye.
Click. I suddenly felt so dirty. Chapter 43. The social began winding down a little after 4 o'clock, and we moved through the cafeteria, shaking hands and migrating out toward the bus for our long ride back to Pine Mountain. Shawnee and I were among the first to leave. I don't think either of us really paid much attention to the group of 4 boys who were waiting around for us by the bus. If we had, we surely wouldn't have noticed that they were not Sacred Heart kids, because they weren't dressed in ties and slacks. They were just scrub kids from Salem, out to watch a rugby game, I guessed. As Shawnee stepped ahead of me onto the bus, one of the boys said, "Congratulations, good game."
"Thanks," I said.
I put my foot up on the first step into the bus.
"I'm waiting to say hi to my cousin," the boy said. "He's on your team. Joey Cosentino, is he coming out?"
I turned around and saw Joey and Kevin,
leaving the cafeteria. He's right back there. I hitchhiked a thumb over my shoulder. Then the four boys walked back to where Joey was, and I watched them. But it didn't look like Joey was expecting them at all. In fact, Joey looked startled when he saw them, and the next thing I knew, all hell broke loose, and someone yelled to look out because the kid had a knife in his hand. I've seen people do some pretty stupid things in my life, but trying to jump a rugby player in front of his whole team has to be about the stupidest. One of the boys ran off right away. I saw Chaz going after him, but the punk had too much of a lead on Chaz. So I thought I'd help him out, which was also pretty stupid, considering my stitches and that other injury I'd been trying to forget, but couldn't because I felt the sting of pain every time I moved my right leg. I caught the kid and took him down right on the wet black asphalt of the Sacred Heart driveway. I didn't get hurt because he was wearing a down jacket and I landed on top of him. But he scraped up his face pretty good when he hit the pavement. I just pinned him down and tried not to get his blood all over my dwindling supply of school shirts, and Chaz caught up to us and kicked the kid twice in the ribs. I know he broke something when he did it, too, because Chaz was never one to go soft on anyone if he decided to actually go that far. "What the fuck are you thinking?" Chaz said, but the kid didn't answer. He just gasped and bled. A lot. And Chaz continued, "You're hardly bigger than Winger. I should just piss on you, you stupid dumb fucker." Well, that really didn't do much for my self-esteem, but I said, "Let me get off him first if you do, Chaz." When I stood up, I heard sirens. Someone had called the police. I looked back to the crowd where Joey and Kevin had been standing, and I saw that Coach M and some other adults were holding on to the other three boys. "Let's take him back to the others," I said. And Chaz grabbed the bleeding kid in a wrist lock and forced him back toward the cafeteria. As we got closer, we both saw that several people were kneeling. Kevin was down on the ground, lying on his back. A nun had her hand on his forehead. Joey was saying something to him. He was holding Kevin's hand. The front of Kevin's shirt was covered in blood, and he was coughing and staring straight up into the sky. Kevin Cantrell had been stabbed. A knife lay on the ground beside his shoulder. The sirens grew painfully loud, and the first cop car screeched up right alongside where Kevin was lying. Chapter 44. Coach McAuliffe rode with Kevin to the hospital in an ambulance. The boy who pulled the knife was taken, handcuffed, in another. Kevin had been stabbed in the shoulder when he tried to take down the guy with the knife. He wasn't badly cut, and Coach assured us he was going to be okay. Not so good for the guy who stabbed him, though, because Joey broke that boy's arm and jaw when he slammed him into the pavement. I honestly think that kid might have died if there hadn't been so many grown-ups around. By the time the cops had arrested the four boys and gotten us all to write out our statements, it was almost 7 o'clock and a cold rain was falling. Coach called from the hospital and told the bus driver to take us back to Pine Mountain. It was a quiet and dark ride home. No singing. I don't think any of us could stop thinking about Kevin and why something like this happened to someone as easygoing as him. It hurt us all because Kevin could accept anyone and anything, which is why we all knew he didn't mind rooming with Joey, something that would be social death to most guys. But Kevin was just Kevin. I hoped it didn't ruin him. JP was still upset about the penalty he'd given up. Every fullback I'd ever known was like that. They had the toughest job on the team, and when they made mistakes, it was usually costly, so they tended not to let go of things very easily. That was probably the biggest reason why I believed our fight was far from over, the fullback psychology. But I knew I'd have my opportunity over the weekend to ruin his chances with Annie once and for all. Shawnee sat beside JP, but JP wasn't talking. He just stared out the window, brooding until he fell asleep. I sat stretched out in a bench seat by myself. I looked back the length of the bus and saw that Joey was alone too. So I got up and
stumbled down the aisle to sit with him. Joey put his arm across the back of the seat in front of him and lay his head down on it. He had to be hurting about Kevin, but who wasn't? It wasn't Joey's fault. "Hey," I said. Joey didn't answer. I never saw anyone on the team cry before, but just then I thought Joey might have been. And I felt really awkward, but I put my arm around Joey's shoulders. And then I thought how stupid I was for feeling like that, because I wouldn't feel weird about putting an arm around Shawnee or Kevin or any other guy friend of mine who was hurting. Shawnee turned around from where he was sitting up near the front of the bus, and he looked at me and mouthed, "Homo," then smiled. That was just Shawnee being Shawnee, so I flipped him off. "Everything's going to be okay, Joe," I said. "You want to talk or something?" Then I patted his head and put my hand down so I could push myself up to stand. "Oh, and hey, I never did say thanks for that pass, Joe, so thanks. Oh, and I'm breaking up with Megan tomorrow, I swear. As soon as we make out one more time, that's it. Well, maybe twice more. Okay, three more times, but that is it." I laughed. Joey looked at me. He looked pissed. "I'm just kidding, Joey." I stood up and looked out the window. "How stupid was that anyway, trying to jump a guy in front of his whole rugby team?" I said. Joey didn't say anything. "Okay, I'll go now. I guess you don't want to talk. Sorry, I just thought this fucking ride was getting boring." "Since when do you cuss?" Joey said. "I cussed when Shawnee stepped on my balls yesterday." "That doesn't count." "In that case, I take back what I just said about the bus ride just to keep my record clean." "Sit down," Joey said. "Okay." I sat next to Joey. "And yeah, it was a pretty stupid thing to do," Joey said. "The one guy said he was your cousin. That's why I pointed you out. I'm really sorry, Joe." "He is my cousin. And it wasn't your fault." "At least Kevin's going to be okay," I said. "He might have saved your life." "Yeah. Do you know what it was about, Joey?" "Yeah, I do." "Okay," I said. "Well, you know I totally trust you, Joey. I know you can keep a secret for me, so if you want to tell me anything about it, it's okay. And if you don't want to talk about it, I understand, too." Joey took a deep breath. He glanced around. The bus was dead. Nearly everyone was asleep. He said, "The kid with the knife. His name's Mike. His brother and I used to see each other. When his folks found out, they flipped. They sent him away to a hospital for crazy kids." "Oh," Joey said. "It fucked him up worse than anything. Mike told me he was going to come after me one day. I never believed him." "Oh. Yeah." Joey cleared his throat. "I never tell anyone this shit, Ryan Dean." "I won't say anything, Joe." "I know." "Did you tell the cops?" I asked. Joey nodded his head. "I wrote it all down, Ryan Dean." "Oh, okay." I drummed my fingers against my leg. That Band-Aid, which had become a symbol of my life, was really starting to bug me. "Hey, Joey, can I tell you about how stupid my mom is?" He looked at me. In the dark, I could see he looked really serious and tired, but his eyes were kind of smiling. "Sure." Then I told him the whole thing about the phone call and the condoms and the "How to Have Sex the First Time" pamphlet, and Joey actually laughed out loud. "Oh, your mom just cares about you, Ryan Dean. And sometimes parents don't really understand the best way to show it. But that is fucking funny." "I swear to God, Joe,
My life is a nightmare.
I don't think so. Not compared to with most guys.
And I haven't even talked to you since the other night, but thanks for getting in Chaz's face, too.
Did you actually punch him? Joey asked.
As hard as I could.
And I'm pretty sure he would have killed me if you didn't stop him.
Damn.
Hey, Joey, what would you do if, let's say hypothetically, you had to sleep in a bunk bed over Betch, and you had a giant Gatorade bottle filled with your own foamy day-old piss just sitting there getting cold in your bed? And Joey laughed again like he didn't believe I was telling him the truth. On that bus ride home, I believe Joey Cosentino and I became best friends.
Chapter 45. By the time we got back to O'Hall, it was almost midnight. Joey and I followed behind Chaz up the stairwell and down the hall. I hoped he'd run into Mrs. Singer, but when I thought about it, it seemed like I was the only boy in the whole building who'd ever had any run-ins with her. Maybe she didn't even really exist. I decided that sometime before Halloween, I'd have to design a Ryan Dean West, is the permafrost eye poison known as the unhot Mrs. Singer actually of this universe experiment, fully controlling, of course, for all unexpected variables. We checked in with Mr. Farrow and said goodnight to Joey, and I envied him for having a room to himself, even under the circumstances. Then I went to the bathroom / execution chamber to pee, and Chaz headed off to our room alone. When I got to the room, Chaz was already in his bed, but the lights were on.
"What's in the package?" Chaz said.
I groaned. A white FedEx mailer was sitting on my bunk. I am such a loser.
"Some porn and a box of rubbers," I said. "From my mom."
"Whatever. You're a fucking dick, Winger."
And Chaz rolled over and covered his head, mumbling something about kicking my ass one day. Confronting Chaz Becker with the truth was the surest way to get him to think I was lying. I turned off the lights and climbed up onto my bunk. I stuffed the package down between the wall and my mattress, right next to the Ryan Dean West emergency Gatorade bottle nighttime urinal repository full of pee. I thought, pretty soon I'm going to run out of sleeping space. I slipped out of my clothes and listened to the rain until I fell asleep.
Chapter 46. I saw Annie at breakfast in the morning. Everything seemed to click back into place and get better on the spot. The whole school was buzzing with the rumors of the rugby riot, and I heard all kinds of bullshit stories from people who weren't even there about Kevin Cantrell almost dying and how the gay kid started a fight. But Mr. Farrow had already told us before we left for school that Kevin was fine and would be back in O'Hall on Monday. So I just shut up when I heard the ridiculous versions circulating, except I did push one boy and call him an asswipe for saying Joey started the fight. I sat down across from Annie. We held hands on top of the table. Isabel, the constant, fuzzy-lipped, flying monkey companion, sat beside her. Shawnee, Joey, and JP were there, too. JP noticed we were holding hands, gave me a dirty look, and then turned his face away.
"Hey," I said, "are you feeling good today?"
"I was back at school yesterday," Annie said.
"I scored a try for you like I said I would."
"I heard all about everything from Sean," she said. "Are you ready for today?"
"Oh my God, Annie, I've been ready for a week." I fired a look at JP. He wasn't watching, but I knew he was listening.
"Let's meet at the front of the office at the start of lunch," Joey said.
Kids who flew home usually rode to the airport together, since seniors were allowed to leave their cars at PM. I didn't even find out until after the arrangements had been made that Joey would be driving Chaz Becker's SUV and taking me, Annie, Chaz, and Megan to the airport with him. Chaz Becker's driver's license had been suspended. Go figure. Joey was going home to the Bay Area. Megan lived in Los Angeles,
and Chaz, I assumed, would be going with her, but I didn't care and wasn't going to ask him. I just wanted to get out of there, even though I dreaded the awkwardness of the long drive to the airport and sitting in the same car with Annie and Megan. But I did come up with a couple perverted fantasies involving getting stuck in a snowdrift and sending Chaz and Joey out into the cold to search for help. Unfortunately, the first snow hadn't fallen yet.
"Did Isabel give you my note?"
I asked.
"Nice space needle cartoon," Annie said. "But you are a total liar about not knowing what was going on the other night, Ryan Dean West, and you know it."
I stared right into her eyes, giving her my most innocent look. I even leaned forward over the table, just like she did to me that night outside O'Hall, when Madam Frosty Mrs. Singer caught us as we were about to kiss. But God, I really wanted to kiss her so bad.
"Oh, really?"
I said.
"Yeah,"
she said.
"Two times balls equals they do the thinking. Oh, which reminds me, how's the SpongeBob Band-Aid?"
Then Isabel laughed. "Score," I said. "Made you talk about my balls. And anyway, Shawnee's making that up. It's a Princess Barbie Band-Aid." Then I gave Shawnee a dirty look and nonchalantly scratched the bridge of my nose with my middle finger. I stood up. It was time to go to conditioning. Chapter 47. Annie and I passed notes to each other all during Mr. Wellens's American Literature / Sex Ed class, and I could tell JP was getting pretty ticked about it. "Oh well," I thought, "I've got all weekend, buddy, and by the time we get back to Pine Mountain, she won't even know you exist." Less than 45 more minutes of sex talk about how gay Henry David Thoreau was, and we're out of here.
"Yeah, but then, with you, it's going to be Friday to Sunday of non-stop sex talk."
"We don't have to just talk." Wink.
"You are so perverted. Try to be nice around my parents."
"And your gay dog. Just remember, I am here to help you through this intense need to kiss Ryan Dean obsession you have."
"Like I said, liar. And you know it."
"Want me to draw you a picture?"
"I don't know. Is it perverted?"
"You want perverted? I can do."
"Ugh. Get me an airsick bag, freak."
"Here you go. Love, Ryan Dean West. 15 more minutes." I drew a comic, my fantasy of what flying with Annie was going to be like. Ryan Dean and Annie are airborne. And so, it's on for this weekend. We'll see who breaks first.
There must be some way I can get Ryan Dean to break down and kiss me.
Ryan Dean?
What?
Nothing.
Ugh.
I just want you to know, I always hold hands on takeoff.
I don't mind, Annie.
I wonder how far she'll go if we hit turbulence.
In your dreams, maybe, West. Love, A.A.
Chapter 48. I knew the drive to the airport would be awkward. Chaz went out of his way to make it even worse than it had to be. After we'd loaded our suitcases in the back of his SUV, Chaz informed me that I would ride shotgun, front passenger seat. And, as Chaz explained, that meant the gay guys could sit up front so Chaz could be in the back seat with what he called the two hotties. Chaz Becker was such a tool. Not that I wouldn't have called them that, much less given just about anything to sit between them. I even tried to argue that it would be more comfortable for Annie and Megan if I did, because I was smaller than Chaz. But Chaz just looked at Megan one time, then gave me a look, like he was about to punch me, and said, "Shut the fuck up, Winger." And when we were on the road, I turned back and saw that Chaz was sitting in the middle with his arms stretched over the seat backs, pretending he was holding on to both girls, just looking at me like he was the king of the world or something, which, for whatever reason, made me think about that bottle of piss I still hadn't gotten rid of. What are your plans for the weekend, Ryan Dean?
Joey asked, paying attention to the road but flickering his eyes to the mirror once in a while to catch Chaz and the girls. Normally, they would have been in Kevin's car, which was bigger than Chaz's SUV. Joey's car was out of the question since it only carried two people.
Nothing boring, I said. No TV watching.
Me and Annie are going to do some running on the beach, I guess. I don't know. Maybe go fishing if it's not too rainy.
Sounds thrilling, Chaz said.
When are you two going to actually start fooling around, or are Annie's parents going to play watchdog all weekend?
Shut up, Chaz, I said. Annie's not like that.
I looked at Annie, and she smiled at me, and then I saw Chaz scoot himself closer to her.
I bet she could be like that, he said.
Maybe I should sit up front, Annie said.
Then Megan tried to change the subject, but chose the worst imaginable direction to steer the conversation.
I bet Ryan Dean's a real good kisser, Annie.
Is he?
As soon as she said it, all kinds of things happened at once. One, I felt my balls actually retract up inside my body cavity. I don't know if I turned white or red, but I definitely felt something turning. Two, Megan got this testy and challenging look on her face.
Definitely the very, very bad policewoman look.
Three, Joey coughed like he was choking on something, then fired me the get-your-shit-together Ryan Dean look. Four, Chaz took his arms away from both girls and folded his hands on his lap, pouting, with a look on his face that said he wanted to snap my skinny bitch-ass neck. He had to know what was going on with me and Megan. I was convinced. Five, and Annie said,
Oh, yeah. He's a great kisser, and he has puppy breath.
Then Chaz said, Do you guys want to pull over and play spin the bottle, or should we just get to the airport in time to catch our flights?
Megan straightened up and winked at me. I didn't even want to look at Annie to see if she'd caught it. This could easily ruin what I was convinced would be the best weekend of my life. I cleared my throat and said, Annie's just messing around. We've never kissed, not even close. And I looked directly at her and said, Even though I've asked her to hundreds of times. So I let her off the hook, for now. I knew she'd think about that. I knew Annie. She wasn't going to let a statement like that go unresponded to all weekend long. So I turned back around, faced the road, and tried to will my nuts back down from behind my belly button, smiling, confident that I'd get Annie Altman to cave into her weakness before too long. Chapter 49. God, was I glad to see our group split up once we got to the airport. We all agreed on a meeting time and place in the terminal after our return flights Sunday evening, then we headed off to our gates. Annie and I checked our bags and took off our shoes to pass through the security line. And, of course, as these things happen to losers such as myself, when I was walking through the metal detector, an alarm sounded because I'd left my belt on. And just when the transportation security officer was waving me to stop, my Band-Aid conveniently came unglued after its two-day vacation on my balls. It fell out of the bottom of my dorky, too-short school pants. This, of course, made the guard think that I was some kind of black tar heroin cakes or whatever the fuck you call them band-aided to my ball sack smuggler. And he and another very unhappy-looking man in a white shirt escorted me behind a thin screen, the kind you'd see in a run-down clinic. That was where they told me to strip down to my underwear. Nice. Annie laughed at me. Well, I think she was laughing at me. I couldn't tell because I couldn't see her since I was standing in my boxers behind a goddamn hospital cloth screen while one of the TSA guys turned my socks inside out and shook them. At the same time, the other agent actually grabbed my now Band-Aid-free balls, and it was probably not in good judgment for me to ask him if he wanted me to turn my head and cough, because he just kind of nodded and said something about me being a smartass, and then he pulled out the waistband on my underwear and gave my actual not-so-smart skinny white ass a glimpse of airport terminal fluorescent light. Annie was doing her best, I am sure, to pretend she didn't know heroin ball sack boy.
Yeah, I'm a loser.
Not just a loser who was still standing behind a screen, barefoot and in his boxers, when he heard the final boarding announcement for his flight to Seattle. The TSA guy just placed my boarding pass on top of my thoroughly ransacked and inside-out school clothes and said, "Sorry, Mr. West, you're free to go." I quickly pulled on my now beltless pants and slid into my shirt. I grabbed my shoes and the rest of my clothes and boarding pass in a bundle under one arm and walked out from behind the screen. Annie stood there laughing, her eyes all wet.
"Why do these things always happen to you?"
she asked.
"Because I'm a fucking loser," I answered.
"Yeah, well, I didn't say fucking, of course. But you know I never cuss, especially not in front of Annie. But to say that I wanted to say fucking is a fucking understatement."
"Here,"
she said.
"Let me help you."
And she grabbed my shoes and belt as I hopped along to the gate, my unbuttoned and untucked shirt fluttering behind me as I tried to pull on one sock and my pants slipped down toward my knees. I dropped my tie and I had to stop and pick it up. I gave up. I followed Annie to the boarding gate, half undressed and barefoot, with one hand holding up the waist of my pants. And the attendant at the gate, who I will say was pretty damn hot in a paramilitary Andrews Sisters kind of way, raised her very disciplined-looking eyebrow as I pinched my boarding pass to her with the same hand I was using to try and keep my pants up.
"Oh, yeah," I said, dropping my tie and one of my inside-out socks at her feet. "I plan on being completely naked by the time we get to our seats."
Chapter 50. "I really do want to hold hands on takeoff," Annie said. I slipped my hand into hers.
"Oh, yeah?"
I said.
"Well, considering I get naked before takeoff, I'd say that exactly 9 months from the moment we fly over the Columbia River, you'll probably be giving birth."
She laughed.
"Pervert."
I buttoned my shirt. I couldn't help myself now. Ryan Dean West, 2.
"So, loser, did you pack the condoms?"
Ryan Dean West, 1.
"Don't be ridiculous. Annie is not like that."
Ryan Dean West, 2. "I bet 5 out of 5 buffalo wings on the Ryan Dean West spice matrix Megan Renshaw is." Ryan Dean West, 1. "I haven't been keeping up with that particular scale, but that stewardess up the aisle has got to be a 4.5. I wonder if I could swing a trip to L.A. next weekend. Just a thought."
Joey Cosentino.
"God damn it, Ryan. I'm going to stop sticking up for you if you don't grow the fuck up. You are finally getting to go somewhere with the girl of your dreams, and you can't stop thinking about every other female on the planet."
Ryan Dean West, 1.
"I'm sorry, Joey."
"Hey, how could you be on this plane?"
Joey Cosentino.
"I'm not. I'm the part of your subconscious that actually, A, knows the right thing to do, and B, is not perverted."
Ryan Dean West, 2.
"You mean there is a part of my brain that doesn't think about sex? You're making that up."
Ryan Dean West, 1.
"Go away, Joe. The stewardess is about to come around to check if my seatbelt is snug enough."
I actually managed to get dressed, shirt tucked, necktie knotted, one sock still inside out but at least in my shoes, before the plane was on the runway, and all this despite the fact that I was wedged into a middle seat between Annie and a drunk, bald, fat guy who fell asleep, sitting on my seatbelt buckle with his head on my shoulder. We were still holding hands when the plane began its descent into Seattle. Me and Annie, not me and the drunk guy.
"This is going to be so great," Annie said.
"What's the best thing you've ever done in your life?" I asked.
"I don't know. What about you?"
"Top 3, I said. My shoulder leaned against hers and it felt so good. "Were those last 2 times you and I were alone at Stonehenge, and being here right now, holding your hand." I looked right at her.
You're trying to see if you can make me do it, aren't you, West?
I wouldn't dream of it, I said.
Sure.
Then she said,
It is not going to happen.
Stay strong, Annie.
You too, Rindine.
Crap. She was playing the same game. Chapter 51 Annie's mother and father were waiting for us when we came through the arrival gate. I had never seen a photograph of them, but they both looked so Annie-like that I would have known them anyway. They were doctors, and they looked so young and healthy. When they saw us, their eyes smiled the same way that Annie's did. Annie's father kissed her, then he held his hand out to me.
You must be Ryan Dean, he said. Annie thinks the world of you.
I looked at her, and she actually blushed. I couldn't believe it. Annie Altman turning red. And I wondered if she had that same inner voice thing where she was currently calling herself a loser, even if I did think it looked totally hot when it happened to her. Blushing, I mean.
Thank you, I said, and then I thought, what a stupid thing to say, so I added, Dr. Altman, which sounded even stupider.
Then Annie's mom hugged me, which kind of flustered me for two reasons. First, because she was a doctor, it made me immediately think she was going to ask me to take my pants off. And second, I have to admit it, being Annie's mom, she was really hot. And she said,
Dr. Altman won't work in our house. We won't know who you're talking to. But you're so polite, Ryan Dean.
Now I was blushing, loser.
You should just call me Rachel, and the other Dr. Altman is Keith.
I hated calling grown-ups by their first names. It seemed so flower-child 1970s to me. So I decided I'd try not to use their names at all, or if I had to, I'd call them Doc Dad and Doc Mom. Annie's father had to drive us to the docks in Seattle to catch the ferry. It was a 35-minute ride to their home on Bainbridge Island. I had never been to Seattle before, and I thought it was one of the most intense-looking cities I'd ever seen, built right up against the tree-lined coast in the shadow of a giant volcano. On the way to the docks, we talked about school and sports. Doc Dad was one of the only adults in America I'd ever met who had actually played rugby when he was in college, so we hit it off right away, even though he had been a loose forward. Loose forwards are usually not the most evolved primates on the planet. Still, I knew I was going to fit in just fine with Annie's family. Hand-holding in the back seat with Annie was definitely off, though. It took only one look from her to quietly get that message to me, and I could feel her getting a little embarrassed again, too, when her father and mother began talking about her.
This is what Annie's told us about you, Ryan Dean, her mother said. Tell us if we're right. She says you are the smartest boy in school, you're a great athlete, and you made the varsity rugby team when you were in 10th grade. And she told us you are the best-looking boy at school, too.
Annie coughed. My ears turned red. You're Annie's first real boyfriend, her father said.
Okay, that's enough of that, Annie said. Ryan Dean and I are just really good friends. That's all.
I guess that whole boyfriend label did kind of make it sound like salmon spawning, as Shawnee might have noticed.
Tell us about where you live, Ryan Dean,
Doc Mom said, turning sideways to look at me.
Ohol, I said. And then I thought, why am I such a fucking idiot? I wasn't even listening to her. I was too caught up in thinking about being Annie's boyfriend.
Annie coughed again, no doubt choking on the thought of bringing a delinquent to Bainbridge Island for the weekend.
I mean, I live in Weston, I corrected. I don't get home much. That's a shame, Doc Mom said. Well, you are welcome to visit us any time you'd like.
I looked at Annie and smiled, and she mouthed pervert to me. We were paused in a line of cars making their way onto the ferry.
Well, what brought you two together?
Doc Dad asked me.
Annie was the first person I met at Pine Mountain, I said. I was really lost and out of place when I started.
I slid my hand over so I touched Annie's fingers,
and she pulled her hand away. But Annie came right up and introduced herself and helped show me around. She's been my best friend ever since that day, and I'd do anything for her.
You are such a sweet boy, Doc Mom chirped.
Have you ever been to Seattle before, Ryan Dean?
No, ma'am, I said, laying it on as thick as possible, momentarily fantasizing about that dreamed-of couch in Annie's bedroom. But it really is beautiful here.
Wait till you see the house, she said. We are right on the waterfront, and we look across the Sound to the Seattle skyline and Mount Rainier. It's a perfect spot.
Yeah, I thought, how could it not be? As long as it's got Annie in it, and you keep her gay dog off my leg, you could live in a fucking plywood lean-to.
Oh, I forgot to tell you, Annie said. Did you bring any swim trunks? We have an indoor pool and jacuzzi.
Wow, I said. No, I didn't. I looked down, then shrugged and looked over at Annie and whispered, I'll go without. Annie rolled her eyes.
We can pick some up for you on the island, Ryan Dean, Doc Mom said.
Score. Even if it rained all weekend, I'd still get to be Annie Altman's pool boy.
Chapter 52. Okay. I realized why my dad refuses to shop for anything, even golf clubs and fishing gear, with my mom. For most women, I think shopping becomes something like a model of the expanding universe. Only, rather than relating to the Big Bang, Ryan Dean West's law of shopping deals with the expansion of time and adorable stuff to look at. Kind of like a supernova rather than a black hole, the opposite of having your balls stepped on, as similar as the experiences may actually be. I can only imagine, not that I thought for even a fleeting instant about opening that goddamned package, that my mother had spent all day long asking all kinds of questions before deciding on just the right condoms and how to have sex for the first time booklet, which she later undoubtedly exchanged for a cute pair of socks with sailboats on them, before ultimately leaving the store and going to a different goddamned condom and how to have sex for the first time emporium. This is shopping. And this was the Ryan Dean West swim trunk shopping expedition with Annie and Doc Mom. At first, Annie was messing around and trying to make a case that I was on the Pine Mountain swim team, so she told Doc Mom to look in the Speedo section. Her mistake. I completely went along with her. What was she thinking? I actually thought it would be kind of hot to wear Speedos in front of Annie and her mom. But when Annie realized what was happening, she got this terrified, defeated look and said,
I think it's time for you to move up to big boy board shorts, Ryan Dean.
No, really, I insisted. Big boy board shorts, what a bunch of crap. The only cool part about the whole experience was that every time they'd look at a new pair of trunks, Doc Mom would hold them up to my waist, pinning them with her thumbs to my hips, so she and Annie could imagine how I'd look in them. Yeah, I'll admit, I didn't get too tired of that routine. And the shopping went on and on until Doc Dad said he had to pee really bad. So Annie and Doc Mom settled on a pair of plain red lifeguard baggies that were exactly the ones I would have chosen for myself about an hour and a half earlier. While they were waiting to pay, Doc Dad leaned close to me and whispered, I don't really have to pee, Ryan Dean, but I've found that the need to pee is about the only force that sufficiently shrinks Rachel's universe to the point where she'll cut short a shopping experience. Now here was a guy I totally understood. I bet he could fake cry, too.
Chapter 53. Green. That's Bainbridge Island. It's one of the most intensely green places I've ever seen. And I never for a moment imagined the kind of home Annie's family lived in. The house was set right up against the shore, facing Puget Sound and across it Seattle. We drove up a long driveway through trees to the garage, and then walked a pathway through gardens that had been decorated with strange and beautiful metal and enamel sculptures of fish, animals, and native totems. Annie made all of these